Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey, friends, and welcome. To this episode of Now Hear This, Canby, I am your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. After drawing condemnation for a one-week indoor dining ban in Clackamas County and 14 other counties that some Republican critics accused of causing whiplash, Governor Kate Brown's message Tuesday couldn't have been more clear. If you want businesses to reopen with few or no restrictions, get vaccinated. Counties in which 65% of residents 16 and older have taken at least the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine will be eligible to move into the low-risk category of the governor's reopening framework, which would mean much greater capacity for many local businesses and fewer restrictions than Clackamas County has seen since the pandemic began in March 2020. That threshold is tantalizingly close in Clackamas County, the state's third largest, where 52.4% had received at least one jab as of Tuesday, according to officials. And Brown promised to do away with the risk levels altogether and lift statewide restrictions with the exception of some mask and distancing requirements based on CDC recommendations when 70% of Oregonians 16 and older have received the first dose. At a press availability Tuesday, she said she believes the state can hit that mark as early as next month. So, Oregon, this is our goal, she said. We each play a part. If you have already been vaccinated, thank you. Now, help a friend, family member, or neighbor make an appointment. Spread the word that folks can call 211 or visit covidvaccine.oregon.gov for more information. The governor credited increasing vaccination rates for heading off the fourth surge of new infections and hospitalizations that caused her to briefly shut down restaurants, bars, gyms, and other venues in much of the state. Thanks to you, Oregon, it looks like we've crossed the tipping point of the fourth surge, said Brown. Our hospitalization rates have stabilized. Our infection rates are on a downward trajectory. And in the race between vaccines and variants, our efforts to vaccinate Oregonians are taking the lead. After achieving a statewide vaccination rate of at least 70%, the minimum threshold for herd immunity, according to health experts, Oregon may continue requiring some use of masks and physical distancing as state officials assess the situation and evaluate the best way forward, Brown said. All other health and safety requirements for counties will be lifted and counties will no longer be assigned risk levels. Public schools will be required to follow state health and safety requirements, but the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Department of Education will also be expected to lift most restrictions based on CDC guidance. For information about COVID-19 vaccination clinics and availability in Clackamas County, visit clackamas.us/coronavirus/vaccine, call 211, or email questions to covidvaccine@clackamas.us. Earlier this month, the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration published permanent rules addressing COVID-19 health and safety guidelines in workplaces across the state, including wearing masks. Originally introduced as a temporary, The rule established various health and safety requirements, such as the use of face masks and other personal protective equipment, physical distancing, cleaning and sanitation, risk assessments, infection notification processes, medical removal, ventilation requirements, employee training, among other requirements. The temporary rule expired on May 4th and has now been replaced by this permanent rule. There were also some minor additions to the permanent rule, including a requirement that employers with more than 10 workers attest that they are running their ventilation system in accordance with the rule. Written notification of return rights for when employees must quarantine is now required. This rule also encourages employers to provide details about leave options. The new rule did not make any changes to the face mask or physical distancing requirements established in the temporary rule, nor did it make any distinctions between the application of rules between vaccinated and unvaccinated employees. Republican lawmakers, including Canby's Christine Drazen, have criticized OSHA for implementing the new rule with no specified end date, though the agency says it will be reevaluated every 2 months, beginning in July. An effort by Drazen and other Republicans in the legislature to delay the rule failed, as OSHA officials reportedly declined to attend a scheduled hearing to review their proposal. "This is the opposite direction of where we should be headed," Drazen said in a press release. "In light of vaccines, improved PPE supply for hospitals and more, we should be giving businesses more breathing room. Instead, this administrative body has demonstrated that it does not believe it is accountable to the people of Oregon." Oregon OSHA officials have repeatedly said they do not want or intend to make the mask mandate truly permanent. Rather, a quirk of Oregon law forces the agency to either let the emergency orders expire after 180 days, May 4, 2021, or make it permanent. Officials say the permanent mandate would then be replaced once the pandemic has passed and masks are no longer necessary. Nevertheless, the permanent rule appears to be deeply unpopular among many in the general public, with Oregon OSHA receiving more than 5,000 comments from the public about this proposal, most of them negative. Nearly 90% of Oregonians say indoor dining should remain open as vaccination rates continue to increase statewide, while new coronavirus infections and hospitalizations trend slowly in the opposite direction. Authored by the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, which has been a vocal opponent of the shutdowns of the industry that Governor Kate Brown has instituted several times since the pandemic began, the survey polled almost 1,000 residents between April 26th and May 5th. The finding was announced Friday, May 7th, the same day Brown's latest indoor dining ban was lifted after being in place only 1 week in Clackamas, Multnomah, and 13 other counties. At the same time, she promised that she would not close restaurants and bars in Oregon again, assuming that expected trends continue. "With Oregonians continuing to get vaccinated each week, my expectation is that we will not return to extreme risk again for the duration of this pandemic," Brown said. Greg Astley, ORLA's Government Affairs Director, said in a press release that the new survey suggests Oregonians, quote, understand what is at stake for their favorite local restaurants. "We have 88% of survey respondents stating they feel they should have the choice whether to dine inside a restaurant or not right now," Astley said. "The sentiment against indoor dining closures at this stage is clearly reaching a feverish pitch." Astley said more than 1,000 restaurants have closed in Oregon during the pandemic, though the Canby dining scene has survived largely intact so far thanks to the support of local community and the persistence of owners and operators. The impact on hospitality workers has also been severe. Astley hoped the reopening of indoor dining just before Mother's Day, restaurants' largest sales day of the year in normal times, would help many establishments that continue to struggle. Astley called on Oregonians to help further prevent government restrictions by getting vaccinated and continuing to support local restaurants. "These are the places where you've celebrated your birthday, had your first date, and enjoyed Mother's Day brunch every year. More indoor dining restrictions would result in more permanent closures of these businesses that are part of the fabric of our lives and communities." In ancient Greek mythology, the Sirens were the nemesis of the Argonauts, Odysseus and many a brave adventurer, their songs so beautiful and entrancing they could entice sailors near enough to shipwreck on the treacherous shores of the island where they lived. Matt Morrissey and the Wayward Sandwiches executive chef Justin Rouse are hoping that their latest venture in downtown Canby, a high-concept whiskey and cocktail bar dubbed Siren Song, will hold similar allure, albeit with a happier ending. "I've always been drawn to water, the sea, and the freedom of it," says Morrissey, whose other restaurant, Wayward, boasts a similarly adventurous brand identity along with a prominent reproduction of The Great Wave, one of the most recognizable ocean-themed artworks, on one wall. Siren Song is currently taking shape at 136 North Grant Street, formerly the home of Balance and Harmony Yoga Studio, whose owners recently moved to the East Coast. "We're running out of kitchen space very quickly at Wayward," Morrissey said with a laugh, "so we've been brainstorming creative ways to address that and expand our footprint a little bit." The whiskey and cocktail bar will feature Wayward's menu offerings along with lighter fare crafted by Rouse and his team, including oysters, pâté, tureens, wings, and from-scratch jalapeno poppers. "We're going to focus on making really good, classic cocktails," Morrissey said. "We're not looking to do anything super weird. We're just trying to make really good drinks." Wayward is known for making virtually everything they serve, including condiments and pickles, from scratch, and Siren Song will be no different. "We're going to make our own bitters," Morrissey explained. "We'll squeeze fresh juice every day. You know, little touches like that. There are several wonderful bars in town, and we're not looking to compete. We want to offer something different, something that's not necessarily being done in the area." The space will boast seating for about 50 guests, including the bar and a mix of custom booths, as well as video lottery machines. Guests must be 21 and older to enter. Its centerpiece will be an 8x37-foot mural by a Bend artist depicting the bar's mythological namesakes. Morrissey is also looking to source antique accoutrement that will fit the theme and local wood for the bar top. "We're thinking we might do oak," he said. "There seems to be an awful lot of oak around, thanks to the old ice storm in February." The new bar is currently under construction, and Morrissey hopes to be open as soon as August. And he said he's grateful for the opportunity to bring a second hospitality concept to downtown Canby. "We're just still so bullish on downtown Canby," Morrissey said. "With the beer library and some of the other things that are coming in, we really think this is going to be a destination area for folks." Sandy Mayor Stan Pulliam will speak in Canby this Saturday as part of a statewide listening tour laying the groundwork for what he hopes will be a successful bid for the Republican gubernatorial nomination in 2022. A two-term mayor in Sandy with previous experience as a legislative aide for former State Senator Bruce Starr and Representative Pat Farr, Pulliam is currently weighing a run for the governor's mansion. Pulliam has been a vocal critic of some of the measures Oregon put in place during the pandemic, particularly ones that have affected small businesses, schools, and churches. In the past, he supported local businesses that chose to buck the state's virus restrictions. He challenged Governor Kate Brown in December, calling for businesses in his community to reopen with high-risk coronavirus guidelines in place, in defiance of statewide orders that were then in effect. More recently, Pulliam announced in a federal lawsuit against the governor last week, challenging her authority in using executive action to extend the state of emergency. Malala Mayor Scott Kaiser introduced Pulliam at Saturday's event. "We've been outspoken advocates for Main Street small businesses and getting our kids back into school," he said of himself and his wife, Mackenzie, who recently founded the Oregon Moms Union, a plaintiff in the case. "And we really kind of caught this wave of momentum and support where people were really asking us to take a look at the governor's race." Oregon has not elected a Republican governor since 1982, when Vic Ataya won a second term over future governor Ted Kulongoski with almost 62% of the vote. Just listening, trying to see how much support we can get, what the viability of this campaign is, what kind of financial support we could get. Pulliam said of the purpose of the listening tour, which has included stops in Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, the coast, and at Fox Park in Malala just this past Saturday. "You know, it's been 40 years since we've had a Republican governor in Oregon, and I think that's because we haven't done the proper legwork to get organized and really run a top-notch campaign, and that's what we're committed to doing here. It's been a wild year and a half to 2 years to be the mayor of your hometown," he said with a laugh. But one thing I've learned is that things are best done at the local level. You know, we've got Republicans and Democrats on our city council. We've got parents and grandparents all over the spectrum. But you know what we all are at the end of the day? We're neighbors. So we tackle these problems as neighbors. Pulliam often struck a more partisan tone during his public remarks, criticizing Brown as well as other Democratic leaders in the state legislature and Portland for their handling of the pandemic, schools, law enforcement, and homelessness, and arguing that a new and more conservative approach is needed. If we focus on issues that can unite us as Oregonians, I continue to believe there's no problem that we can't take on, he said. There's a spirit to this state that I think we've kind of lost in recent years and that we can restore together. Pulliam will hold a listening session from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday, May 15th at Waite Park in Canby, hosted by City Councilor Sean Varwig, who also attended the Malala event. Oh, I am excited to host Mayor Stan on this stop of the tour in our town, Varwig said in a press release. I invite the community to join us to get to know Stan and share with him what our community needs from our state.
Hey Tyler, I was reading an article the other day and I saw that 53% of Americans say they value technology even more since the COVID outbreak.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that article in Obvious News Weekly.
Okay, you don't have to be mean.
Seriously though, it is true. I know that I can't function anymore without all of my connected devices. And I heard that DirectLink saw a huge spike in internet traffic after the stay-at-home order began last year.
Yeah, it's a good thing DirectLink works hard to provide constant, reliable broadband service even during tough weather, peak use hours, and that big jump in increased demand.
Right, and we need access to a quality connection more than ever. We're working from home, the kids are still distance learning, and I've even had a few online doctor's appointments.
Yeah, not only that, but so many of our entertainment options have gone virtual. There's streaming TV shows and movies, Zoom game nights, and online gaming, so people really need reliable internet.
Wait. With all of that extra online activity going on, don't we have to worry about usage limits and high bills from using too much data?
Come on, Tyler. How many times have we been over this? DirectLink doesn't have data caps and doesn't charge extra fees for high usage. It says so right there on their website. Visit directlink.coop today to learn more. All right. Well, I'm here with Ryan Oliver and his son, Kellen. Hey, guys.
Hi. Thanks for meeting us.
We are here on a beautiful day at Wayne Oliver Field. Wayne Oliver, Ryan is obviously your dad and the founder of Oliver Insurance, but he was so much more to this community. I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about Wayne and really just kind of how it feels being out here and seeing that name up there, Wayne Oliver Field.
That's pretty cool. man, I couldn't even start to say where it all began. If there are so many things he was involved with.
Right.
Just business-wise.
A real community leader.
Community guys. Yeah. I mean, if there is a board.
Hey, Coach.
Tyler?
Yep. Hey, JJ.
If there is a board, if there was a board in the within 20 miles, I'm pretty sure he was on it.
He was cheering it.
I think my mom used to say when people would ask me what my dad did for a living, I would say he goes to meetings. But, you know, he did all that, but never missed a beat, never missed any of our minor or my sister's activities. So it's pretty incredible how he did it all. But yeah, he was, I mean, Chamber, Rotary, Clackamas Community College, Camp Utility, I mean, the list goes on and on. Lions Club, I think the JCs, I think maybe used to be what it, I mean, there's, I was looking through the stuff and I'm like, I don't even think that's around anymore, but yeah, he, and then he did the baseball stuff as well. He started coaching back in the mid-60s, I believe, when he got out of college, or
did
maybe
he
during
play?
College. He played at high school here.
Yeah.
And then he went to the University of Portland, but didn't play there.
Yep.
But then he started coaching, and at some point, I think he was coaching a couple teams at once, but that's where he kind of got into it.
Yeah.
And then him and some other guys, Bob Rapp, and some other guys created the Canby Kids organization.
Okay, so he was part of the founding of that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Back in the day. And so, and then it just kind of, you know, You know, Cammy's grown a little bit since those days, but yeah, that was kind of the deal.
And so
ever since, and then baseball was his true passion, and so he kind of just stuck with that, and that's you know, as they say, like father, like son. So here I am.
Here you are, literally. So you were telling me before we started recording that this one of the houses that's right here, literally on the fence line of Wayne Oliver Field, was a home you grew up in. Was the baseball field here then?
Yes. So we moved here in 19.
So no wonder we're so into baseball. Yes. You couldn't escape it.
Couldn't escape it. So 1979, we moved here in 1979. The field didn't quite look like this, but it's the same spot.
Yeah.
Same orientation, but it was way scaled down, as things were back in the days.
Yeah.
So we grew up in the bullpen.
Yeah.
Of this, and so he started coaching here then with Coach Junior Sato, in 1980, I believe, was his first year coaching. So he went from kind of the little guys to the high school level and was a varsity assistant for about 8 years. But our house was, now if you can fathom this, there was no water or power out here at the time. So anything water, like, so to keep the infield green, we'd run hoses.
No way.
From there, the hitting machines, we'd run cords. After games or before games, if someone needed to use a telephone, right inside that sliding door, we had a phone that was on the wall, and it had about a 15-foot cord on it, so the kids would just line up on the porch and say, hey, we got a rain out, I need a ride home, or whatever it is. That was the concession stand. That was the garage was full of
Your mom was the concessionaire.
lawnmowers, rakes, all the gear going there. Some of the closets we didn't use had all the uniforms in it.
That is unbelievable. That's
so
amazing.
So this was essentially, you know, the umpires would come in there and change and put their black shoe shine on our carpets. So that was the clubhouse pre-clubhouse.
The baseball house. I love it.
That was it. And so, that was basically my childhood. And then, so we would take care of it. So that was kind of my first jobs as a youngster, was essentially going here and picking up garbage and mowing and making sure the field looked good.
Do you recall where your dad's such a passion for baseball came from? Was it sort of an extension of just his love of the community?
I'm sure that's it, but I think back in those days, you know, his best friend was Frank Cutsforth. And so those guys, I mean, they just love, I think, all sports, but I think back then baseball was a little, you know, was truly the sport of sports back then. You know, now maybe football or what have you, but the baseball was the deal back then. And I think they just loved, you know, collecting cards, going to game. I mean, they just that was their deal. So I think that's kind of where he kind of fell into it.
Yeah.
And it was something he could do. I don't think he played football, so that was his passion, and he kept with it.
Absolutely. Your father has passed. He passed away about 5 years ago.
Seven years.
Wow. A little bit before we started doing all this, but I know it was a unexpected and a real big blow to the community.
He was on his way. I was supposed to pick him up at the airport at like 5 a.m. So he was going to fly down to Arizona to watch his grandson play. He was playing for Whittier University or Whittier College at the time, and they were playing in Phoenix. And so he was, we left maybe Kellen's, one of my son's basketball games that night over at night school. And I was going to see him in the morning, or supposed to see him in the morning, take him to the airport to watch baseball. And somewhere between there and there, he passed of a heart attack.
The reason I said 5 years, it's obviously time has gone so crazy, but I remember the 5 year back in 2019, back when things were normal. I remember a few people just in the community, kind of not part of your family, just community people, remarking on the 5 year, and that they couldn't believe that it had been 5 years without Wayne.
It's been fast and slow at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So obviously, Wayne lives on here at Wayne Oliver Field, his namesake, which was named after he passed, I believe.
Correct, yep.
Okay, and then through the Wayne O Foundation that you're really involved in. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the Wayne Oliver Foundation came about, so back in the late 80s, my dad and Frank Cutsforth and Wayne Scott and some other gentlemen created a kind of a booster club for the baseball program, and they did some auctions, and so it really transformed this field from kind of the Common Joe High School field to, at the time, was one of the better ones in the state. And so that was Cougar Pride Baseball. So that went on, and my dad kind of ran that and then I got into it once I got out of college and started working. It was in coaching baseball here at the high school. Mm-hmm. Then I got involved in it that was probably 8 or 9 years ago, when the administration said we don't want to do booster clubs for individual sports. And so at that time, it was kind of disappointing, because I know high school coaches, they like to coach. They don't like to spend, nor do they have the time to spend raising money. And that was kind of our deal. And so that was fine. And it so it happened that my mom had passed about right about that same time frame is when they said we couldn't do it anymore. So my mom had just passed away of ALS. Mm. And so we had a golf tournament going on that was the Cougar Open at the time. Mm-hmm. That was a baseball fundraiser. And so my dad said, well, why don't we change it if the high school, if the high school, and I don't say that the baseball program didn't want it, but the administrators apparently didn't want it.
Yeah.
So my dad said, why don't we do the golf tournament for ALS? Mm. And I said, that's a great idea. And so we started, that year was going to be kind of towards ALS and moving forward. And it was still, at that point, it was still the Cougar Pride Baseball. Mm-hmm. And before we had the first golf tournament, my dad passed. So we didn't even they both passed within 5 months of each other. And so we didn't even get a first go of just the ALS one. And so at that point, I kind of said, with our board of directors, why don't we switch the name to the Wayne Oliver Foundation and then kind of just spread the love as best we can.
Yeah. To local
charities.
Yep.
And so
absolutely.
That's kind of how the Wayne Oliver Foundation came about. Was that, and now it's still going, and the community has been so supportive of it. It's been fantastic.
You've got the tournament coming up this summer.
Yes, June 18th. We'll be back out at Willamette Valley Country Club. COVID permitting, I guess.
Right.
It's pretty fluid, but so far so good.
Did it happen last summer?
It did happen last year. We had to change the format. We had to go, we couldn't do our normal shotgun.
Yeah.
We had to use tee times, and then we couldn't do our kind of dinner and an auction.
Right.
And so that hurt a little bit. It's always, but still it was, I was just hoping to break even last year just to get people keep doing it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, for me, it's my Christmas.
It's hard to take the year off.
And so it's just good to see everybody. And so we did it, and we ended up raising, like $10,000.
That's awesome.
With a short, we had to reduce the teams by about a third. Mm. So it was still fantastic, and we did it. And this year they say we're going to go back to the shotgun for format. That was obviously Kate Brown's latest transgression. So so we'll see. So we don't know. It's always fluid, and I'm guessing we'll pull it off one way or another.
Yeah.
I just don't have a crystal ball to tell you what it's going to look like in June.
No, I don't think any of us do, for sure. In normal years, with the auction and everything, how much does the event tend to raise?
Usually we do about, we're able to give out about $15,000.
Yeah.
A year is kind of been about the normal.
Yeah.
So we're coming right up, I should have looked it up, but we're coming right up on about I think about $100,000 we've been able to give out in the course of the history of the Wayne Oliver.
Yeah.
The Wayno. So
that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been especially this last couple really impactful and kind of crazy years, and definitely a lot of needs.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And so we, you know, just where the money goes is obviously ALS is a big deal for my family as well. And so we do a portion of it to ALS every year, and then we do a big portion to, or not a big portion, about an equal portion to Canby Junior Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you can see, like Canby Junior Baseball has been really good. They put on all the jerseys.
The Wayno logo
goes on all those, so we support that. We give a little, you know, we give some to the high school program here.
Yeah.
And you know, to help keep the facility with the namesake on it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've had some deals. We've had a few years ago, we had a young man, Callan, was actually on Callan's baseball team, who had cancer. And so we put some money into that.
Yeah.
And then we, when the Schlatter, when AJ passed away, we put some money. They were doing a scholarship fund up at Portland State, I believe, and so we helped out with that.
Yeah.
So usually we try to find, I mean, we have our kind of our staples, if you will, and then unfortunately there's always seems to be something that comes up of something's going on or some type of need, and so we try to put money into that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the last thing I did want to ask you about was that logo, that very distinctive logo, is obviously Wayne's face. The Wayno Foundation itself, just kind of, you know, as someone who never, unfortunately, had the pleasure of meeting Wayne myself, but it seems like with the logo, with the foundation, you kind of seem to try to be capturing a little bit of maybe his spirit or kind of the fun-loving aspect of who he was, as well as the community giving aspect, obviously.
So the history behind the logo, so as I showed you earlier, we were the first ones in town to have cable television.
You had a plaque.
We have a plaque. So we were the first ones.
In addition to being the baseball house.
Yes, we were the first ones in Canby to have cable television. So with that great honor meant my dad got to watch baseball. Now, my dad was a Dodger fan.
Mm-hmm.
But the Cubs were on every day on WGN, and they played day baseball.
Yeah.
And so Harry Carey was their TV announcer.
Sure.
And so, so when Harry's passed away, the Cubs, Chicago Cubs, did a patch. They're very similar. And
yeah.
So
yes.
I had, so my, when my dad passed, I had one of his, my dad was one of those, he had a coffee group in the morning that he had coffee with. And Mr. Warren, he was an artist, and did some great drawings on my dad, and did some of my nephews. But I took that picture of Harry Carey to him, and I said, "Make this my dad." Mm. And he did, and it's pretty amazing how spot on it is, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I get a lot of comments like, "Boy, that's that is I you know that's it."
Yeah.
And so. So that's where the logo came from, and so it's funny because, you know.
And that is amazing how a good artist can sort of capture a likeness like that with just what, like 7 or 8 lines.
It's it's a couple, you know, some glasses and a couple squiggies here and there. And, but it's amazing how many people, you know, if we're out of town or doing and we have something Wayno on, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, "Hey, Harry Carey," and then you're like, "No, close, but you're on the right pit. You know, you're on the right path. That's good for recognizing." But so that's where the logo comes from, and so you know, we try to get that face out there, everywhere we can. Just to, you know, it's fun. We used to have with the shirts from the golf shirts, we used to have a "Where's Wayno?" and people would go put it on social media, like, you know, with their Wayno shirt on, like kind of the one on my back on. And they would post it
on your back. Yeah.
They would post it from, you know, the beach or some, you know, top of a mountain or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to see people. And
And I've seen you have some fun with the logo and social media. There was a mask version came out
last year. We had the mask. We were hoping to maybe we'll have to put some type of a vaccine or some type of a syringe.
There you go.
In it or something like that. But we try to, you know, we try to keep it you know, we tried to have a little fun with it, I guess, you know, as he would like. He was a pretty loose guy, and so you know, try to respect it.
Absolutely. Okay, well, as we wrap up here, obviously still some questions about exactly what the tournament's going to look like this year, but are there ways right now that folks can either find out more information, stay tuned, places they can get information when it is out, or ways that they could even register now?
They can go to the website, which is www.WayneOliverFoundation.com.
Okay.
That's our golf, and so it's got all the if you wanted to do sign up to play or just sponsor or just find out more about it, kind of it's got pictures of previous tournaments, just kind of what it's all about, or if you have other questions, they can, you know, reach out to myself at the office, Oliver Insurance, 266-2715. Or Facebook. It might be on some other, that's the only social media platform I'm on, but my wife is kind of handling that, so I'm sure it's on some other platforms. Facebook.
She's a little more savvy with all that than
Ryan, Control Alt Delete is kind of my and turn on and off. That's my tech savvy. that's what it is, but we're, you know, if you're not able to play, we're, you know, we're always looking for people to help out, we're just trying to do good things for the community. That's what my dad always did, and so we're just trying to carry that legacy on, and obviously the more people that can help us out with that, the more things we can do, or maybe if they have ideas on where to go with that. We also did Pass It On Canby, which is the you know, people, so we helped out kind of with some, get them started with a little bit of some money to help with some costs. So we're always looking for ways to just to do good, and so if there's ways to help, either by bringing it to our attention or with, you know, some money of one way or another, we're all ears on that. So but I just want to thank the community again for everything they've done. It's been fantastic. You know, it's bittersweet, but it's been great, the response. So thank you, Canby.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Ryan, for your time. Thanks for you and your families and all your supporters work with the foundation. That is one thing that I think is so special about Canby, is the things that make it unique and the way that the community remembers the people that that have made a difference, the people that tried, you know. And I really appreciate that about Canby, that we don't just move on and kind of leave that in the past, that we hold on to those things. So thank you for your part in that.
You bet. Thank you. Have a great day.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time, and sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime. I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me. Three generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? We have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me. We are.
All right, we draw this episode to a close with the return of Candy Then, one of my favorite segments because I get to learn so much about the history of this beautiful little town of Candy. Candy Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They're not your average antique shop, and they're open daily. You can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grand Street in downtown Candy, that's opposite Wake Park, or connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. Well, as you know, things have been a little interesting around Clackamas County these days. So the crew here at Now Hear This Canby hasn't quite had the time to do our usual digging through the dusty tomes to discover the gems of local history that we love to share. But as it turns out, we've all just had the experience of living through history, and we wanted to share a few stories you probably hadn't heard. So our own Tyler Frankie, the man, the myth, the legend, took a recent trip to the Clackamas County Fairgrounds this week to hear from volunteers who have been caring for hundreds of people and thousands of animals evacuated from their homes due to the wildfires. And here's what we heard. They called it Noah's Ark, a small building on the Clackamas County Fairgrounds stuffed with dogs, cats, turtles, people, a rabbit, a dove, and a handicapped duck. Noah had it easier, though. He only had two of each. "We had over 1,400 animals at one point," recalls Kurt Vandenbroek, a member of the all-volunteer Clackamas County Sheriff's Posse, a critical part of the annual county fair, as well as the impromptu one that was staged there as wildfires forced thousands to flee their homes with all manner of pets and livestock in tow. "Goats, turkeys, there's pheasants in that barn over there," says Drew Cosland, standing behind the red gate at the fairgrounds on Saturday evening. "We briefly step aside as a pickup truck carrying three people and 13 ducks, all bidding loud farewell, rolls by." Kausland, an iron worker and welder by trade, wears his trademark black cowboy hat with a large feather of some variety stuck in the band. As far as I know, it came from one of the ducks. "More cattle and horses than anything," Kausland continues. "It's been the most controlled chaos I've ever seen in my life." For Kausland, the crisis began early. The night the fires broke out in Clackamas County, September 8th, he and his girlfriend, Angie Zeiss, got a call. "Hey, so do you have any trailers available?" Zeiss recalled with a laugh. It was neighbors needing to move over a dozen horses as flames spread rapidly westward and northward toward Malala, Colton, Estacada, and the surrounding rural communities. "Oh, we just scrambled," says Kausland. "I called the fairgrounds. I think it was around 10. I said, hey, we're coming with horses. I've got 14 coming right now, and there's probably going to be a lot more. And we've been basically going since then." For Kausland, for Zeiss, who is the 4-H pygmy goat superintendent, like her mother was before her, and for Vandenbroek and so many of the other volunteers, the fairgrounds feels almost as familiar as their own homes and stables. "We spent a lot of years down here," she says. "When all this happened, you know, this was home. We just pulled together. I don't know day from night at this point, but we'll be here till it's all over." I ask what the motivation that has been to keep them all going, and Kausland is almost as confused by the question. "Well, people needed help," he said. "I mean, we've all said it multiple times, but this is what we do. 4-H, rodeo, it's all a big family. And it doesn't matter if you're blood or not, we'll do what we can to help you out." Considering that Noah's Ark was on the premises, perhaps the night crew should have not been surprised by the floods. It happened last Thursday as the much-anticipated rains finally brought some relief to weary crews battling wildfires aided by unbearably dry conditions. But the charred, bare earth wasn't ready to absorb the deluge, nor was the Clackamas County Fairgrounds stormwater system. "I was up to my knees in water," says Cole Carroll, then reconsiders. Probably a couple inches below my knees. "His boots are still drying," adds Cosland, who had been called to Montana for work at that time. The Rosebook Arena, which houses 20-some horses, flooded, and it fell to Carroll and a few other volunteers to get them out. "Oh, no, they weren't having it," Carroll said to one of the horses. "I got kicked. Whew! Still hurts." "Horning Hall flooded," says Zeiss. "It was nuts to see how much water was coming down. We thought we were at the tail end of it, but hey, you know what comes out of the tail end sometimes." And there have been moments of fun. One of Zeiss's first nights, an evacuee came up to her. "I know this is going to sound crazy, but I swear I just saw a chicken over there," she recalls the woman saying. It was not really a crazy proposition for Noah's Ark and all, and sure enough, the two women soon found a bush that was shaking suspiciously. "It squawks and takes off running," she says. "It wasn't a chicken, though. It was just a pheasant. They managed to catch it in the morning." They might not have caught the piglets that escaped on the other day if it not for Zeiss's 10-year-old daughter, Addison Hettinger. She was the only one that could catch them, she says. If you ever need exercise, go chase piglets. That wasn't all Addison was up to either. She also cleaned bathrooms, shoveled stalls, took the garbage out. Oh, she's been busting her buns, says Zeiss. Hardest working 10-year-old I know, added Coslett. For more tales from the Clackamas County Fairgrounds, find the story on our website, canbefirst.com. And tune in next time for Can Be Them. As always, friends, thank you so much for listening. I'm James Walton. Have a great day.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? Even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling?
Or no.
That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net.
Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.